But first, it isn't every day when the President of the United States turns to you for advice. But Flint's Mayor Dane Walling is now in that relatively small group who can say exactly that. Mayor Walling was among 18 mayors who sat down in a White House meeting with President Obama. The topic, how to reduce violence among young people. And that's something Dane Walling is faced with every single day. That's because Flint is among the top U.S. cities of more than 50,000 people with the worst crime rates. Mayor Dane Walling joins us now. Welcome back to Stateside.
Oh, thank you so much.
So tell us, Mayor Walling, what did you personally hope to accomplish in this sit down with the president?
I wanted to thank the president and the attorney general for the additional federal law enforcement assistance that has already been provided to Flint. And then, of course, being a mayor, when you express your gratitude, you also have a request for more help and assistance. So with the other mayors at the table, we were all able to articulate a number of needs that we have, from early education and ways to engage families through the educational process, how to better deal with ex-offenders and get them tied into the workforce, as well as just better and more efficient law enforcement work with more technology, with more data, more collaboration across our local, state, and federal agencies. All of that was on the table with the president.
Now, you were there at the White House, and there, as we had said, a meeting with President Obama and then another with Attorney General Eric Holder and 17 other mayors, including Mitch Landrieu of New Orleans and Cory Booker of Newark and Kevin Johnson of Sacramento. So from all corners of America, were there more similarities or more differences in the stories that each of you told to the president?
Absolutely more similarities. What we're faced with across our communities, whether crime overall has been up a little or down in each of our communities on an annual basis, we're all experiencing spikes in youth violence. Had tragic incidents this past summer where young people have lost their lives in the city of Flint, and every mayor at that table had similar stories and expressed the heartache that that's caused all of our communities, but then also the collaboration and the new ideas that have come forward to try to prevent those future deaths and really save lives.
Was this your first meeting with President Obama?
It was in a sit-down, serious business sense. I've met him on a number of other occasions and had the opportunity to talk briefly in more of a reception environment. This was the first time that I sat down with him at a table and really went to work. He led the meeting. He had Valerie Jarrett on one side and Attorney General Holder on the other, and then, you know, 18 mayors who wanted to talk to him about crime and preventing youth violence. I made sure he knew that we want to have him back in Flint as president and address these issues with our community.
What did he say to you, Mayor Walling, directly? And was there anything that surprised you, caught you off guard?
Well, in the exchange that we had during the meeting, I specifically made the point that we need to have more services for our young adults because we have young adults that are disconnected from the workforce, disconnected from a positive educational experience, and in too many cases, they're the ones who are influencing our youth. They're providing the negative role model, and the president picked up on that point. Made a comment about the restraints with a lot of federal programs being age-specific and what we're able to do after school. So no easy answer there, but he really engaged on that point of more services, more flexibility with programs so that we can serve this young adult population because without getting to that group, as we invest in school programs, as we invest in early education, the benefits of those are going to diminish if they're not nurtured through that individual's life as they get older.
Now, in the meeting with the president and then the subsequent meeting with Attorney General Holder, did you hear anything from other mayors that intrigued you, perhaps ideas that you might want to bring back to Flint to augment your existing efforts?
There were a number of them. Mayor Cory Booker highlighted a program that they've put in place, really an initiative more than a single program for ex-offenders. So Mayor Cory Booker outlined a way that they've connected with individuals as they come out of incarceration and have almost a fraternity-type environment where services, traditional human and workforce skills are offered, but also things like free pro bono legal services to assist with clearing up other legal issues that may have gotten worse while an individual was incarcerated and not able to appear in court and the paperwork wasn't done right. The other thing I heard from almost all the mayors was that they were working on some type of focused deterrence like we've tried here in Flint, the ceasefire, we now call it Lifelines program. We need to invest more in that program to get more of a return. We've got a great coalition in place. We've had more than a dozen individuals called in for their confrontation with the community to try to turn their life around. But this work is being done in a more robust way in a lot of the larger cities. I think that holds a lot of potential for us, too, because the cost of incarceration is so high for our budgets, for our families, for our communities. We have to invest more not only in prevention but also deterring individuals who may have started down that road before they get too far.
You know, let's take the cynic's view for a moment. Did you walk away feeling that something very substantial happened in that meeting, or could it be argued that it was a gesture or window dressing, if you will?
Well, the president started the meeting on a very strong note. He said, Mayors, I'm not here to ask for your support to go to Congress to announce a new program. That's not what we're in a position to do right now. But I want to have a brainstorming session with you about how we can use our existing resources to get better outcomes. And I think the president was right on with that, because if you look at the size of our budget for Homeland Security or U.S. Department of Justice, it's hard to argue that we need more money. What we need is to have a mission focus, and that mission focus needs to become in 20 or 25 cities across the country that have experienced high rates of crime and especially youth violence, that there's a concerted effort with the federal agencies, state and local, county involvement to really move the needle on that rate of crime. And that's what I believe the president is going to follow up with the attorney general on. During that hour-long meeting, the attorney general is furiously taking notes. So you could tell the president has made this a high priority for the attorney general. So that's what I'm looking forward to coming out of this. Not a new initiative or a new spending program, but a mission where federal resources will be dedicated, in our case, to Flint, many other communities, in a way that over the next year to two, we can substantially change the level of crime and violence in our communities.
Mayor Dane Walling, there are those pessimists who will look at Flint and say aloud, how can you save a city that has seen so much economic stress, which in turn has bred so much violence and created an unsafe environment? Do you in your heart think there will be a time when Flint is safe? And in your eyes, what will that actually look like for Flint?
I believe that we are going to get there, and it's going to be through coordination and collaboration. And for anyone who wants to argue with me on that, I'll simply point out that Flint has been afflicted with disagreement and with dissension for my entire life. But we've now come together around a common, comprehensive plan for the community under the Imagine Flint Master Planning process. The longest chapter in the plan is on public health, safety, and welfare. So people in this community are fed up with the violence. They're ready to work together for whatever reason. And if we can get our local, state, county, and federal law enforcement and support agencies focused on this task, then I believe we can see in Flint the same kind of success that other cities like New York City have been able to see when they get that mission focus and that collaboration. And that has never been tried in Flint. That's what we need to do. That's the only way that we're going to truly reverse this terrible trend.
And how long do you think that might take?
I think we're already making good progress towards that goal. With the Governor's Secure Cities Partnership, we have extensive Michigan State Police resources operating within the city. And we have had good federal support from the U.S. Attorney's Office, the ATF, and other agencies. But there needs to be even greater collaboration, and there's going to have to be a greater dedication of resources. If we can get that work done in the next 3 to 4 months that are remaining here in 2013, then I believe 2014 can be the beginning of a lower crime chapter for the city of Flint.
Mayor Dane Walling, City of Flint, recently back from a White House meeting with President Barack Obama and Attorney General Eric Holder. Thank you so much for talking with us, Mayor Walling.
Thank you, Cindy.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Over the past 12 years, nearly 50,000 American troops have been wounded in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The visible injuries are often lost limbs from roadside IEDs. But there are so many who are coping with the non-visible injuries, post-traumatic stress disorder, traumatic brain injury, the kinds of injuries that can worsen with time and tear apart a soldier's home life or worse. We're joined here in the studio by a retired Air Force major who's come up with what he thinks will be a perfect refuge for these vets, Camp Liberty, using the beautiful outdoors of mid-Michigan as a place of healing. Major Rick Briggs, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
Well, you're the manager of the Veterans Program for the Brain Injury Association for Michigan. Give us a sense of what you see as these soldiers come home from Iraq or Afghanistan, or these Marines, and they're suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder or traumatic brain injury. What kind of symptoms are they dealing with day in and day out?
Well, there's a myriad of symptoms, but for example, there's cognitive things. And some of the most obvious when we first talk with an individual that show up, you might see somebody stuttering or a delayed reaction in their speech. Memory is one of the very first things, even with a mild concussion. There's anxiety and depression and a lot of other. There's 33 different ones that we track. And it impacts relationships and all this. And, for example, we'll get a student going to college. A lot of our veterans are coming back. They're unemployed or whatever, so they're capitalizing on the GI Bill. They're going to a university or college, and they're trying to move on. But one of the issues they're having, the ballistic shockwave that emanates from an IED, improvised explosive device, rocket-propelled grenade, mortar, whatever the blast was, it tears at the neuron and subneuron level, and it stretches it and the synapsis gap, and it impacts the individual's memory. And if you think back to your college days, you got to have memory to pass the test and so on. So we've had calls from professors and so on. We're involved with the Student Veterans of America, SVA, and so on, to educate not only our students but educate the professors on how to penetrate and get the word through. I had two soldiers currently serving that are extremely concerned about their jobs. They're 4 or 5 years post-injury. They came home. They thought it would get better and go away. There's a stigma associated with the invisible wounds. They don't want anybody to know that their brain's not functioning at the level it needs to, like it was before. So they're just now finding out that, life is harder than it should be. I'm concerned for my relationship with my family, my community, my job. They're concerned about promotions, everything.
And, so it spirals. It spirals.
It spirals, and it can get significantly worse.
Is it treatable?
Invisible wounds, both PTSD and TBI, are treatable. One of the things we all need to understand with post-traumatic stress disorder, it's a psychological response to a stressor. It's not a combat-specific injury. It can happen out on the street, seeing a child get hit on a bicycle or something with a car.
So it's not like the traumatic brain injury that is actually an
traumatic
injury.
Brain injury is a physical injury, and we got to think of it like you're breaking a bone.
Yes.
And Gabby Giffords, the representative that was shot down in Arizona, she brought a lot of light to this. But this goes all the way back to Jim Brady with Ronald Reagan when he was shot. And, our association's been around 34 years, the Brain Injury Association of Michigan. And So we've got to do a better job attacking the stigma that's associated with things that impact the mind.
And the problem is with a neurologic injury, it's not like a broken bone where you can say, okay, put it in a cast and in 6 weeks you can go into a splint and then you should be good to go.
That's true, but they can retrain. Mm-hmm. The brain is very soft, first of all. A lot of people think it's like a heart or a liver or something, but it's a very soft, kind of like a cooked custard. Mm-hmm. And it is damaged very easily. Look at the sports concussion. Mm-hmm. And I don't care if you're a cheerleader or a soccer player. So we have got to get better at working with everybody on the brain injury and the PTSD.
I'm speaking with retired Air Force Major Rick Briggs, who is the founder of Camp Liberty. And this is an idea of taking the beautiful outdoors of mid-Michigan and turning it into a place of healing. So what gave you the idea of Camp Liberty, Rick?
Well, when I retired from the Air Force, I took on professional bass fishing. I chased the national circuit for 4.5 years full time. And it's always been a great escape getting, you know, and your listeners know. I mean, there's probably somebody shaking their head right now saying, hey, I wish I was in a trout stream. You can forget about the office real quick when you're sitting out in a blind, watching the world turn, watching a chickadee land on the end of your gun barrel. I mean, it's such a wonderful, relaxing impact on your psyche and so on. And Mother Nature's a marvelous remedy for de-stressing. And that's something that's very, very helpful to our vets. And one of the things – and Camp Liberty is more of a program than it is a location. I want to make that clear, because what we're talking about is – we're talking about utilizing recreation. And in Michigan, we're blessed with an enormous asset of outdoor wilderness, waterways, rivers, everything. And we're going to take the recreation. We're going to include the rehabilitation component. And then we're going to talk about reintegration, because it's not as simple as just coming home from combat, hanging up your gun,
putting
on your civilian clothes and going. It's much more complex. And we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of thousands of troops over the past 12 years. I've known guys that have been on 7, 8, 9 tours, mm-hmm. and which is crazy when you think of it.
So your hope is for Camp Liberty?
My hope is for Camp Liberty. We're going to take the programs. For example, there's a Michigan Access program where farmers can provide access to hunters to come use their property, maybe to hunt turkey or squirrel mm-hmm. or rabbit or whatever that hunter allows, or maybe it's deer hunting or whatever. And we're going to expand that. We're going to get a program specifically for veterans. We're going to get one for individuals with disabilities, and that's all the injured soldiers and civilians and so on.
But you have land in mid-Michigan?
Yeah, we have land. My best friend, Alan Lutz, who's mm-hmm. a U of M graduate, he and I went on our own, put our tails on the line, and we bought a $400,000 facility, 137 acres along the River Raisin, down in the Manchester, Brooklyn area. It's just a beautiful piece of property.
And what do you want to do with that piece of property?
What we want to do is we want to develop a main lodge, about a $400,000, $500,000 lodge. It'll sleep like 16. We want to bring families in as intact units when we're talking about our injured mm-hmm. vets, because they have to heal together. There's a lot of secondary PTSD and other things that happen in the group dynamic, the family unit, and they all have to be educated on it. The habitat program is being done in 3 phases. We just got the first one underway.
You'll ultimately have a retreat near Manchester, right. Brooklyn, but you'll also have access to other activities throughout the state of Michigan.
Throughout the state of Michigan. And Camp Liberty is going to tie directly in with the Sharonville State Game Area, the Pheasant Restoration Initiative. We're going to be building habitat there. And our goal is over the next 5 years to build 50 inclusive opportunities around that 4,500 acres in Jackson County and Washtenaw County for everybody.
And how do you want this to be different from other support programs and rehabilitation programs?
What we're doing right now is we're creating it's on the drawing board, and we're creating the program where a Pheasants Forever group from Jackson County that wants to take a vet out or something, they have a follow-on to just taking them out hunting, that they hand them a package, this vet, and they say, you know, here's some support programs and so on that are here to help, and other opportunities and other organizations. And so it's getting them to understand it's invisible, but it's treatable, and the treatment works.
So you really want to build a network with wildlife and outdoor groups all through the state to kind of partner with you in Camp
right.
Liberty.
The state of Michigan. I want to talk about our the rehabilitation component, because we're talking recreation, rehabilitation, reintegration. You know, the three R's. And the state of Michigan is the gorilla in the whole country when it comes down to community based TBI. Rehabilitation providers, and a lot of these units also specialize in PTSD and spinal cord injury and so on, from acute, subacute, all the way through to returning to the community, which is what the ultimate goal. Whether you've had a car accident, which is one of the leading causes of brain injury, California has 8 CARF accredited community based TBI facilities. Michigan, and they're number 2, California. Michigan has more than 70. We have more than 30 other states combined. We have more than 1,000 certified brain injury specialists. We have more than 10,000 people working within the brain injury community. Mm-hmm. So these facilities are scattered like McDonald's all over the state of Michigan, and we need to capitalize on that opportunity in conjunction with the VA, TRICARE, which is the health care program for our veterans that are currently serving National Guard and Reserve, and the DOD for the folks that are in part of a community rehabilitation program that the military has.
What's your timetable for having your retreat in Brooklyn and Manchester? When do you think you're going to have that together? When do you want to have that together so people could come and...
It can't happen fast enough. The thing with these injuries, especially with TBI, you have a diminishing window of opportunity to rehab that individual. It needs to be ideally within the first couple of years of injury, and we're already 12 years into it. So there's some guys with injuries that are 8, 9, 10 years old. It can't happen fast enough. I want to open our doors next fall, and I'm talking about having the facilities, have the main lodge. We want to have a chapel annex. We want to have an education center. We want to have 5 kind of like Ronald McDonald House or Fisher mm-hmm. Homes for families to come in to use. All of this for free for vets, mm-hmm. And then they come in there and they stay. It's a vacation for them, whether they're dealing with employment issues. There's 5 major issues facing our vets, and most people know. The suicides, we're experiencing 26 a month. That's more than we're losing in combat. The divorce rate, the homelessness, the joblessness, and the incarceration rate. They don't understand right and wrong because their brain has had this impact, and they need to be retrained. So we're wasting a lot of money in our prison system. The Department of Community Mental Health, it's so much more expensive to care for a person for life that's having these issues than it is to treat it up
intervene
front.
When they come home.
Absolutely.
Well, I know you're always looking for volunteers as well, mm-hmm. and you can find out more about Camp Liberty at their website, which is camp-liberty.org. That's camp-liberty.org, and we'll put a link on our website at michiganradio.org so you can find out more. Major Rick Briggs, the manager of the Veterans Program for the Brain Injury Association of Michigan and the founder of Camp Liberty. Thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Students in Michigan schools are back at their desks. And for young football players, soccer players, and other athletes around the state, practice has been happening in earnest for weeks. This is the first school sports season under Michigan's new sports concussion law. We wanted to find out just what it means to student athletes, to their coaches and trainers, and to their parents. Joining us is Laura Rowan. She's an injury prevention consultant with the Michigan Department of Community Health. Welcome.
Hi, good afternoon.
So the new sports concussion law went into effect this past June, so Michigan is now the 39th state to have a law like this. What is it meant to do?
The law is meant to, first and foremost, educate parents, student athletes or youth athletes, and people who are involved in youth athletic activities about sports concussions, the risks that they pose to young people, and how to engage in safe play.
And how does it work? How will this happen because of the law?
Well, the law requires that the organization that is overseeing or the athletic activity, that they are obliged to provide educational materials to youth athletes and their parents or guardians about sports concussions. Also, if a youth athlete is suspected of having a concussion during an athletic activity, that they are immediately removed from play And this is to protect and safeguard that individual, but also that they are not then allowed to return to play until they are cleared by a health professional who has the ability to make that determination.
So the idea is no more, I can shake it off, coach, I want to get back in.
The mantra is, when in doubt, sit them out and to play it safe.
Now, when we're talking about the new sports concussion law, to whom does it apply? I mean, we're looking at schools. Does that go all the way up to colleges and universities as well?
Well, the law is specific to those individuals who are younger than 18.
And is that all groups? So it would be Little League, soccer, community, schools, churches as well?
It's absolutely. It's not specific just to school-related activities.
Laura, how will the law be enforced? And by that, I guess I mean, who is there to make sure that the coaches are abiding by the law, and even the young athletes, that they're not pushing themselves and getting back in there?
The law does not specify any specific authority to monitor or provide oversight or enforcement for how this might happen. So that's yet to be seen and to be determined. We haven't seen that play out yet.
But I would suspect if, let's say, a parent was concerned, there would be now a place to go and something to invoke if they go to school authorities and express a concern, for instance. So you've got this law now backing you up.
That's correct. And it would probably play out litigiously. It would be for our courts to decide how that would be carried out.
As an injury prevention consultant with the Department of Community Health, what do you find are the biggest misconceptions about concussion?
One misconception is that helmets prevent concussions. They don't. They help protect against skull injuries, and they could very well help lessen, you know, impact, but a concussion is what happens when your brain moves inside your skull. And so it's another misconception is that if, you know, I'm okay, I only had my bell rung. Well, that could actually be, if that's what you're experiencing, that could actually be a sign of a concussion. And the whole objective of this is to provide really good and better education around what that means.
Laura Rowan is an injury prevention consultant with the Michigan Department of Community Health, and you can find out more about Michigan's new sports concussion law. Just go to the website, michigan.gov/sportsconcussion. That's michigan.gov/sportsconcussion. Laura, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you so much, Cindy, and thanks, too, for the reference to the website. I appreciate that.
A judge in Indiana has ruled that that state's right-to-work law violates a provision in the Indiana Constitution, a provision that bars the delivery of services without just compensation. The judge found that the law wrongly requires unions to represent workers who do not pay dues. You may recall Indiana became the 23rd state and the first in the Midwest to ban the collection of mandatory fees for representation from unions. Joining us now is Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. He, of course, has been covering Michigan's right-to-work law, which was passed last December. Rick, help us understand just what this judge in Indiana is saying here.
Well, I think you pretty much outlined it. There's this codicil in the Indiana Constitution that deals with delivery of services without just compensation. And what the judge said is that unions have to represent people. That's actually in federal law, that if they're in the bargaining unit, they have to represent everyone equally, whether or not they pay union dues. And so what the judge in Indiana said was that, well, that is accepting delivery of services without compensation. So it does seem to run afoul of this part of the Indiana Constitution that will no doubt be appealed to the Indiana Supreme Court. And I've read from some legal scholars who say that this is, in fact, a little bit of an advancement of where the law in Indiana traditionally has been, because that has applied to individuals and not to entities like a union, like a bargaining unit.
All right, so they'll be breaking legal ground in Indiana. What about implications for Michigan's right to work law? I mean, understanding this was only a provision within Indiana's state constitution.
Right, and Michigan does not have anything that specifically says that, you know, you can't just take services without just compensation. We don't have that. So I doubt we'll see a similar challenge, but we do have some legal challenges working through the system right now. Some of them deal with things like whether or not the legislature complied with the Open Meetings Act during that free-for-all that was the session last December that yes. enacted the right-to-work law. One that might be sort of related to this is playing out in Southeast Michigan, where the Mackinac Center, a very pro-right-to-work free market think tank, has sued the Teamsters that represent city workers. And what they've done is they've sort of come up with a fee-for-service arrangement that they've said that we'll charge a minimum of $150 to process a grievance. And if it's being processed for someone who's a dues-paying member, we can expect that would be waived. And if they're not a dues-paying member, well, this is a way to make sure that the costs of filing grievances are covered. The Mackinac Center says that's not the way that the federal law works, that you have to represent everybody equally, and it is the price that the union pays for being the sole processor of handler of grievances for the employees. That's a codicil in a lot of contracts that says that if there is an employee grievance, that it needs to be run through the union. And so the Mackinac Center says that's the cost of that arrangement.
Is this something that could actually make a difference, or is it more a case of two opponents on either side of this right to work law poking each other in the eye?
Well, I'm clearly that is part of it. And, you know, the more that these things play out, the more that the unions get to remind people that there are people who are accepting union services, you know, without paying for them, which is allowed under the state right to work law, you know, and for the unions, it just keeps, you know, the issue front and center in that respect. And for the backers of right to work, it requires them to come back and explain that there are actually a lot more nuances to employer and labor law than a lot of people know about.
Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. Thanks so much, Rick.
Oh, my pleasure as always, Cindy.
Quick, how many Facebook friends do you have? Well, it might give you a little bit of a warm glow to say 200, 400, even more. But that warm glow might be misleading. The University of Michigan recently made worldwide headlines with a study that finds the more you use Facebook, the unhappier you're likely to be. The author of that study joins us now. Ethan Cross is an associate professor of psychology at the University of Michigan, where he directs the Emotion and Self-Control Laboratory. And joining us is Cliff Lampe, associate professor at the University of Michigan School of Information. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
I will start with you, Ethan. What prompted you to construct this study to examine this question of how and if Facebook affects our happiness?
Well, you know, there's tons of data in the psychology literature linking human social network interactions, so our interactions with other people in our day-to-day lives, with a number of important health and well-being outcomes. If you look at online social networks, in particular Facebook, in the grand scheme of things, they've been around a lot less than everyday human social network interactions. And when we first started at looking at this technology, we realized we knew a lot less about this. And so we wanted to see, given how frequently people are interacting with Facebook, how does it predict people's well-being over time? And that was a question that hadn't been looked at.
And dare I say it, Cliff Lampe, the idea of being on Facebook, as new as it is, in many lives, I think is one of the leading ways that we feel plugged into our friends.
For many people it is, though not really usually for close friends. A lot of the other research on Facebook has shown that it's usually pretty good for keeping in touch with distant contacts, but people have other ways of maintaining their relationships with their closer ties.
But boy, I'll tell you, just based on myself, my circle of friends, having Facebook on our smartphones, it's being checked in on constantly. And to think that we didn't even know what Facebook was a few short years ago.
Right, which is pretty interesting, I think, from the science point of view. This is a relatively new technology, right? Less than a decade old, and it's become pervasive. So it really raises numerous questions that will likely take decades to address, and researchers from lots of different disciplines are beginning to do so because it is such a new and interesting and pervasive form of social network interactions.
So how was the study done?
So what we did is we had people come into our lab. They filled out a few background measures, including a questionnaire that measures how satisfied they are with their lives. And what we then did is we explained the study to them, that we would be text messaging them 5 times a day for 2 weeks, 14 days. Each time we text messaged them, we asked them a series of questions that they could complete relatively quickly in a matter of seconds. One of those questions had to do with how they felt at that moment. Another question had to do with how much they had used, interacted with Facebook since the last time we text messaged them. And another question had to do with how much they had interacted with other members of their offline social network, if you will, since the last time we text messaged them.
The real world.
The real world, so which we defined as face-to-face or over the phone. And we asked people these questions 5 times a day for 2 weeks, and then we brought them back to the lab and had them fill out that life satisfaction questionnaire again. And then what we were really interested in is, how does using Facebook or interacting directly with your network at one moment in time, does that predict changes in how people feel from, you know, the time period before we text message them to right after?
Yeah.
And the key finding was, the more people used Facebook during one period of time, the more their happiness levels declined over that time period. Hmm. We also found that when we looked at average Facebook use over the duration of the study, over that 2 week period, the more people used Facebook over that 2 week period, the more their life satisfaction levels declined over time. So on two different ways of assessing well-being, let me back up. Subjective well-being is often defined as consisting of two components. One is an emotional component, how people feel in the moment, and then another one is this more what we call a cognitive component, people's assessments of how satisfied they are with their lives. And what we found is, on both of those metrics, the more you use Facebook, the more your well-being declined.
So kind of a Facebook fail when it comes to happiness and satisfaction. Cliff Lampe, did this surprise you?
So, you know, the study's very cleverly done, but I think sometimes the media on this has made bigger conclusions than I think would be warranted from the finding. So, you know, one important thing to remember is that because of the way they were asking questions, the measurement of use was a single item measure. And there's lots of other research that shows that people use Facebook in really radically different ways. So how much they use it isn't maybe necessarily as important as how you use Facebook. And there's been other literature, for instance, that shows that people who passively consume Facebook do display much more loneliness than people who are active on Facebook. So we've known for a while that how you use Facebook can really be associated with different types of affective states. So I think this study raises some great questions that we could pursue further down the road.
And when you say passively using, are you talking about like what the kids call creeping?
So yeah, or lurking.
Lurking.
What older people would call lurking. So if you're just reading what other people are doing, then you get maybe some of the social comparison that the authors of this paper have talked about. So, you know, maybe you're just comparing yourself to people's self-presentation online. But people who are more active on the site in terms of posting and sharing links with their friends and basically engaging in actual relationships with people tend maybe not to have those types of outcomes.
And Ethan, what was your sense from your research? Why does Facebook make people feel sad or lonely?
Well, you know, so that's not a question we were able to address with the data we collected, but we're looking at that now, and I think this distinction between passive and active is a really interesting and important one. We've been speculating about it. You know, the other research that was just mentioned certainly points in that direction. I think the critical test is going to be whether passive Facebook use leads to changes over time in some of these metrics, and likewise, the flip side to that, does using this technology actively lead to improvements, as some people have claimed? Those are open questions, at least the longitudinal component of this, to my knowledge. And those are things that we're beginning to look at.
Now, I wondered, were the subjects students?
The subjects were students. So one of the things, and I agree, too, that, you know, sometimes the media can get carried away with things. And,
yes.
And certainly there were some headlines here that were cringeworthy, to say the least.
I don't think you're the first researcher to say that either.
Yeah. You know, we tried to be really careful in terms of constraining the conclusions that we drew from this work in our paper. We focus on a particular demographic, young adults and students, and we suggested very clearly, and we believe it to be the case, that we need to look at how these results might generalize to other age groups. I mean, that's a really important question given the statistics on the different demographics that use this technology. Young adults certainly comprise a major user demographic, but they're by no means the majority.
And correct me if I'm wrong on this, Cliff Lampe, because I know studying communications, this has got to be in kind of, you've had your eye on this. I know when I personally jumped on Facebook, my then teenage daughter had felt that was her world. So number one, she was appalled and wanted me to shut my Facebook page down, which I didn't do. But I know that my friends and I, as baby boomers, we do use Facebook differently than my college-age daughter, for instance. So would there be a good reason to expect a different result from studying older Facebook users?
I would think that's a reasonable belief, right, because we do know that older folks, you know, anybody above college age does have fairly different practices when it comes to Facebook.
Yeah.
And the other really big change we've seen over the past few years is that as older folks and moms and dads have moved to Facebook, change in the population that was studied for this research has really changed. So, you know, a lot of younger college and high school age students have moved to other sites like Instagram and Snapchat.
Right.
And
they don't
like
want to be where we are.
Traditionally, right?
Yeah, and just to add on to that, I mean, this is a shifting target because even the platform itself, right, Facebook continues to be evolving in how it allows users to interact with it. So from a research standpoint, it does make it tricky to try to pin down how different pieces of this are, in fact, influencing people when those pieces are changing. So,
what is the lesson of your study, do you think? Is it, you know, limit your time on Facebook, or it can be like junior high and you wonder why you're getting snubbed when someone won't like anything you put down or comment on anything?
Well, you know, I think the lessons are twofold. Number one, I think what our data suggests is that the way the young adults in our sample normatively use Facebook, mm-hmm. right, the way they naturally use it, which some of our subsequent data shows, is primarily for passive consumption reasons. Normative Facebook use is in fact leading to these declines in subjective well-being. And I think that's a finding that people should be aware of, right, because mm-hmm. they can choose to use this technology, not at all, or perhaps differently. But I think the bigger question is really what this conversation has circulated around, which is trying to get a more fine-grained understanding about how different aspects of this technology could, in fact, undermine or the opposite, really serve to boost people's well-being. Those are big questions that I don't think, you know, one single study is going to address in the future. We're going to need lots of work to do that. And the hope is that future research makes use of some of these kinds of longitudinal designs that really allow us to examine that question in a rigorous way.
Has there been a study as far as the satisfaction rate of using mainly texting versus, say, actual conversation over the phone, which is something that I think I see in my kids and their friends, where, God forbid, we actually talk. Let's text. And context, as you know, changes so much through a text. And I just wondered, when we're talking about relative satisfaction, has that been looked at, or are there plans to look at that?
Yeah, there's been significant work. Sometimes we call those affordances, right? So voice has, and phone has an affordance, which is basically you can hear the tone of my voice.
Yeah.
That carries different information. Text has fewer of those affordances, but text is good for lighter weight messages. What typically happens is that texting can be really great for certain types of messages, and phone can become more important for other types of messages. So for a lot of the messages that the teens are exchanging, phone is a fairly heavy cost in terms of, you know, it has to be sequential, you have to be at the same time talking to one another,
yeah.
Whereas texting is much more lightweight and can be a more appropriate choice. In the work that we've seen, nobody's done a study that I've seen that shows that students who are texting or young people who are texting have worse relationships than previous generations.
Hmm. It's something that we've all talked about as parents. You know, what's happening to these kids today when all they want to do is text and not actually talk?
If it makes you feel any better, parents of a previous generation had the same conversations around the phone.
Okay, there we go. Good point. Thanks so much for communicating with us today.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Ethan Cross is an associate professor of psychology at the University of Michigan, where he directs the Emotion and Self-Control Laboratory. And Cliff Lampe is an associate professor at the U of M School of Information. And speaking of communicating and social media, we love reaching out to you and hearing from you. You can find us online at michiganradio.org. On Facebook, search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty, and on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Mercedes Mejia, and Katie Suha. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening. And let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.